be seated. Calling our third case of the day, State versus AG 22AP 652. Could I please have your appearance?
Attorney Katie
Kapowski,
appearance for the State of Wisconsin. Attorney Courtney Rowland, appearance for the State of Nevada.
Attorney Chris Sully,
appearing on behalf of AG. All right. The lineup I have is the two of you are splitting 30 minutes, 15 and 15, right? And then 40 minutes, and then 5 minutes each on rebuttal, correct?
That is correct.
It's a little extended from what it typically is, but gives you a little more room to argue. Okay, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the court. As I indicated, my name is Katie Gutowski, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. I am one of the two petitioners in this case. This case is about recognizing the distinct differences between criminal and termination of parental rights cases and not strictly applying criminal appellate procedures to TPR cases. I have two main points this afternoon. First, that the Bangert decision regarding totality of the record needs to be clarified to include post-plea proceedings in termination cases. And second, that default judgments should apply to termination of parental rights appeals if an appellant fails to appear at a remand proceeding, because quite frankly, a child's permanency shouldn't be delayed waiting for a parent to participate in court.
Isn't your position infirm? That's a pretty good word. Isn't your position infirm with regard to default judgments here because neither the state nor guardian ad litem asked for a default judgment at the time?
Your Honor, I do not believe that that's the case, primarily because there was significant discussion regarding AG's non-appearance. Also, as far as the state's research is concerned, there is no precedent for a default judgment. So given that there was no basis, I don't believe that it's waived.
Did you make a motion? Did anyone make a motion for default judgment?
No one made a motion for a default judgment.
An order on default judgment.
I apologize. Could you rephrase that? I didn't hear it.
Did the court issue an order on default judgment?
The court did not issue a default judgment for AG's non-appearance at the remand proceeding. In the underlying termination case, the court did issue an order requiring that AG appear at all hearings.
But that was lifted, right? The default, the one that was issued was lifted, right, at the time of the plea hearing?
There's essentially two missed court dates in this case. At the initial appearance, the court ordered AG to attend all court hearings. At a hearing that was scheduled for AG to enter a plea, he failed to appear or appeared and then disconnected. The trial court did indeed find him in default at that proceeding. Several months passed, and prior to the convening of the dispositional hearing, that default was vacated, and we proceeded. The trial court's order mandating that AG appear at all hearings was not lifted.
So help me out here, though. It's a remand. The prima facie case was made, and that's what, on remand, no one appealed that. You did not appeal that. So the state has the burden of proof at this remand hearing, right?
That's correct.
So why does AG have to appear? The state still has to prove it.
It is the state's burden of proof at the remand hearing. There's a couple key considerations the state has with the significance of AG's non-appearance and the hindrance it places on the state's ability to proceed. AG requested this remand hearing. This hearing occurred based on his request for a post-disposition hearing. Subsequently, the state typically will call a parent, but also may call trial counsel. AG did not appear, so there's also an issue with whether or not there would even be the ability for trial counsel to testify because of privilege.
Okay, but if they made the motion, I think the argument could be made that they waived the privilege.
That would be something that would be at issue. I had concern that it was not.
Okay, none of this was briefed to us, right? This whole issue of, I mean, and it's really not, this is not essential to the findings in this case. I get that you want to, this is your, like, you gave us, I think the two things you gave us were your platinum standard. You want us to find those two things. But in reality, actually, I'm looking at the two things you started out with. We don't actually need to find either one of those to rule in your favor, right? We don't need to deal with Bangor, changing Bangor, and we don't need to deal with whether default judgment should apply to TPRs. We can still find in your favor, right?
That is correct. There could be a situation of error correction in this case. I think that the state's request for the clarification under Bangor, number one, is only as it applies to termination cases. The state's not asking that this court make any alterations to Bangor for criminal procedure. The underlying court of appeals decision cut off its analysis at the time the plea was entered.
But do we even need to go past the time the plea was entered? I mean, really, if you look at Bangor, you look at what we have already, do we really need to change what we have to set up the framework here, which is we don't need to look at what happened after the plea. We can look at the plea and everything leading up to it, because I think everyone would agree that that's what Bangor says. And isn't that enough?
The state is not conceding that there was a plea colloquy defect in this case. The state's not conceding that for purposes of this court's review. So in some sense, we don't have to go past the plea proceeding. However, I think what makes termination cases unique is that what occurs at a dispositional proceeding, due to the unique nature of termination cases, can yield insight into a parent's level of understanding at the time the plea was entered.
Yeah, but as we can see from these briefs, isn't that tough, that level of insight that you want us to take after the fact? Because there's arguments made on both sides that what he said supports your position. So why would we venture down that road of trying to determine what somebody, whether what they said post-plea, what significance that meant? Because it cuts both ways. I could read it one way and I could read it the other way. So why would I look at it as indicative of whether or not he understood his rights at the time?
Stepping outside the factual scenario that we have in front of us with this case, I think that that's true, that it could cut both ways. I think that the trial court can place whatever weight and credibility that it sees fit to post-plea disposition evidence, but to completely create a bright-line rule, as the Court of Appeals tries to suggest, to eliminate it from the trial court's consideration is concerning. That's what I'm asking that the state, or that this court do, is that allow trial courts, as the fact finder, to consider post-plea transcripts and determine whatever weight or credibility they could hold in assessing what a parent's level of understanding was at the time of the plea. As it occurred in this factual situation in front of us, the parent testified less than 24 hours after he entered a plea.
I'm going back to this infirm argument. The issue, as I understand it, is did AG forfeit his right to appeal when he did not personally appear at a post-disposition evidentiary hearing because the circuit court could have entered a default judgment against them had the state requested one? That's what I label infirm. I label it infirm because, number one, no one asked for a default judgment. Number two, the court didn't enter a default judgment. Number three, in order to enter a default judgment, the court has to make certain findings. In other words, the egregiousness of it. The court made no such findings. So what are you doing arguing this third issue? It seems more than infirm here.
There is a history that a parent must take an active role in a termination of parental rights case, both predisposition, a parent can be found in default for failing to timely join issue, failing to comply with court orders, and even post-disposition, there is a statutory history for a parent's requirement to be involved. They not only have to sign the notice of intent to appeal, but also the notice of appeal itself. I am asking this court to also deem that a default judgment would apply to appellate litigation in termination cases. And I think that if this court were to do that, then the subsequent procedure is that this would be remanded back for the trial court to make an assessment as to the egregious and bad faith nature of AG's non-appearance at that hearing that he requested.
I'm not understanding your reading of Bangert. Can you help me out? I mean, I'm reading Bangert to say, let me get it up here, that it's they're looking at the totality. We hold that although the no contest plea, and in Bangert it was held, the colloquy was held to be insufficient to ascertain the defendant's understanding of the natures of the charges against him, the totality of the circumstances, including the record made at the post-conviction hearing on the motion knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered. So I'm reading Bangert to say it's a totality of the circumstances analysis that a trial court judge needs to undertake, right? And I'm looking at the Court of Appeals, and the Circuit Court undertook that analysis. The Court of Appeals didn't agree with the conclusion, but I don't understand what you're asking us to do that is different than the totality of the circumstances.
The underlying Court of Appeals decision looked to State v. Brown. State v. Brown enumerated a list of possible options that the state could present in its argument regarding totality of the record. One of the options enumerated under the Brown case is transcripts of prior proceedings. It's the state's position that the Court of Appeals interpreted Brown to prohibit an assessment of post-plea proceedings, because Brown cited pre-plea proceedings as an example. Brown obviously is a criminal case.
I'm looking at paragraph 16 of the opinion that I think you're talking, the Court of Appeals opinion. It says it's just giving an example, and one of the examples is that they can present testimony of the parent and trial counsel to establish a parent's understanding. I mean, anything that they testify to could be post-plea, right? So this is where you think it's limiting. I'm not seeing it the same way you are.
The state's analysis of the Court of Appeals decision is that the Court of Appeals did not consider the post-plea evidence in its assessment of AG's understanding at the time that the plea was entered. The trial court did. I'm asking this court to clarify that the post-plea proceedings can be considered, and as the trial court is the finder of fact, and asking that the Court of Appeals decision be overturned in its exclusion of consideration of the post-plea transcript.
What is the rule? I mean, I read Bangert to say the totality of the circumstances. What do you want us to say? Like, by totality of the circumstances, we mean the totality of the circumstances? Like, I don't know how we could say it any better.
I agree with that, quite frankly. And in writing my briefs, I kind of struggled in the same capacity to say totality, to truly mean totality, specifically in a termination case, pre-plea and post-plea, because of the unique nature of termination cases. The line of Bangert cases and the clarifications to the Bangert line of cases all are taken under the umbrella of criminal cases. In termination cases, because of the bifurcated nature of these proceedings, a lot happens after a plea is entered, which is different than criminal procedure.
So just to, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
So I just want to clarify, because you did make some briefing about, in your briefing talked about, potentially modifying Bangert, doing something unique in these cases, and I had a question on the two. But what I hear you saying is, really, because Bangert says, all right, prima facie case, then it goes back, state needs to prove its case, can look at everything. You can look at the whole record. That's the language that's used. And I'm not hearing you argue with that standard at all. I'm hearing you say maybe the Court of Appeals didn't apply that correctly in your view, and that we ought to be able to consider things post-plea as part of the proof that the state would, prove whether it was knowing, intelligent, involuntary. So you're not actually asking for a modification to Bangert or the legal standards. You're just asking us to say that it was wrongly applied in this case.
That is correct, with the clarification. I think that the guardian ad litem may ask for a modification to some of the procedures, but the state is asking that the clarification really be that the totality truly means totality, both both pre- and post-plea.
You know, I never thought anything differently. So
I know.
That's perplexing to me. You know? Where in the Court of Appeals opinion do you point to that causes you to say that the Court of Appeals believes that in TPR cases you can't, that totality does not include post-conviction?
The part of the Court of Appeals decision, I believe, is paragraph 24 that talks about the Finley, Bangard, and Brown line of cases and the court's reliance on the designation that it be assessed at the time that the plea was entered. What
sure.
The state doesn't disagree with, the state's argument is that post-plea disposition testimony can be very telling. In this case, the alleged defect has to deal with dispositional alternatives, and then the state would argue that AG's testimony at the dispositional hearing provided relevant insight into, I apologize, I am out of time. May I finish my sentence?
The sentence, yes.
AG's testimony at disposition can provide insight into his understanding 24 hours prior.
Maybe when you come back up, I think it's paragraph 16, because it's not at 24, but maybe you could clarify that when you come back.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
I apologize. I'm just going to adjust this a little bit.
Oh, please do.
Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Courtney Rolance, and I am the second petitioner in this case, representing the minor child's best interests as guardian ad litem. This case is about prioritizing function over form. I have three main points. First, on behalf of the minor child, we are asking this court to clarify what burden of proof governs disposition under Wisconsin Statute Section 48.426. Specifically, the burden of proof in the first phase of TPR is clear and convincing evidence. And this court should extend that burden of proof to the second bifurcated phase called disposition, meaning that the petitioner should prove by clear and convincing evidence that TPR is in a child's best interests. Second, there are two main procedures governing withdrawal of a plea in Wisconsin criminal procedure, and neither of them cleanly apply to TPR proceedings. This court should create a hybrid standard governing withdrawal of a plea in TPR proceedings that allows a trial court to review the entire record, both pre- and post-plea, to identify any defects in the colloquy and to discern whether there is any claim that a parent truly lacked understanding.
Counsel, again, I'm going to ask you, I come to preparation of this case with a belief that totality means totality. And both in the criminal venue and in the TPR venue, that it includes when you're looking at whether or not the plea is knowingly, voluntarily made, and you have the hearing, I'll call it the Bangard hearing, that it does include post as well as pre. But you think as the law now exists for TPR, you can only look at pre-dispositional and not anything post-dispositional? Is that your argument?
Your Honor, I think that this is a kind of two-pronged answer. As to a prima facie case, I think that the cases of specifically State versus Howell from 2007 and State versus Finley from 2016 act to say that at a prima facie stage, you cannot look at the totality of the circumstances.
Sure, that makes sense. I mean, you know, that they have to aver a prima facie case, right? Let's say the plea colloquy is defective, right? That's what they aver in a Bangard case. And then if they aver that and also make the averment that they would not understand, that they didn't understand whatever the missing part was, that establishes a prima facie case. And then the state has the burden to show that they knew anyway. And the state can prove that. The state can prove that, I don't want to say by any means, but almost any means, you know, whether, and the means are listed, you know, whether it's talking to a friend, whether it's some kind of transcript pre or post, whether it's the attorney's testimony. I mean, so I have some problems because I'm not sure I agree with the deficiency in the law, which seems to be the premise of arguments made here.
Your Honor, I am offering or arguing that at the prima facie level, the court should be able to have the power to dispose of a motion that on the face of the record is insufficient. So for instance, in this case, we have a situation where AG alleges that the court told him the wrong burden of proof at disposition. I think there's two issues there. One, we don't know what the burden of proof at disposition is, but the burden of proof that he believed she told him was actually applied at disposition, which we can find in that dispositional transcript. His second issue was that she did not adequately explain dispositional alternatives. I take issue with whether there is an error there, because she did say to, in fact, terminate your parental rights, the inference there being you will or you will not. So I do believe that the dispositional alternatives were explained. But again, if you go to that dispositional transcript, he argued the next morning to have his child returned to his care or to the mother's care and returned to a CHIPS case, which is dismissing the TPR case. And so at the prima facie stage, the law, as the Court of Appeals has looked at it, and as it's listed in State versus Howell and State versus Finley, the court was powerless to look at those facts before it decided whether or not an evidentiary hearing was necessary. And to go back to your original question,
is the prima facie case in front of us? I mean, I thought that's like been decided, right? That was the first Court of Appeals decision, and then they said that the burden was met, and so we went back and had the remand hearing. Like, is that in front of us, do you think, today?
Your Honor, I do think that the Court of Appeals relied on its first decision, and the first decision was heavily discussed within that second hearing. I do think that they're both in front of this court. I think that the court also has the power to consider that case if
couldn't
it wants
you have
to.
I don't understand why, if you disagreed with that decision, the first Court of Appeals decision, you could have appealed that to us at
Your
that
Honor,
time.
I apologize, Your Honor.
That's fine.
We could have. I think that there is a inherent consideration here that there's a child that's behind this, and I believe, at least from my perspective, trying to get through this appeal as expeditiously as possible was the first consideration. And so the Court of Appeals says no in AG1. We go to an evidentiary hearing. We try to do what we can with the transcripts. And here we are again. This court is empowered under Vollmer versus Luetti from 1990 to consider issues that go directly to its institutional lawmaking responsibilities and capacities. And so if the court finds the prima facie issue to be interesting, it does have the power to reach back and look at that today.
What was your third point? You had three things you were asking us.
I thought you had four.
Thank you, Your Honor. It was three points. Okay. My third point is that this court should hold that default judgment applies to appeals and if an appellant fails to appear at a remand proceeding. So turning to my first point, the foundation of an adversarial legal system requires that there be an evidentiary burden of proof at TPR disposition despite the statute's silence.
But let me just address that issue. So that's ordinarily true, but these are kind of unique cases, right, where there is a statutory standard of clear and convincing evidence at the first phase, right?
Correct.
So that's a, you know, there is a burden that has to be met in order to show that you're, you know, legally unfit.
Correct.
The statutes, as the legislature has written them, clearly impose a clear and convincing evidence standard for the first thing. And they clearly do not say that for the second phase. They just say the standard is best interests of the child. I don't understand sort of theoretically why the second phase would need to be adversarial, since the first phase is where that really takes place. And secondly, why we would impose something that the statutes very clearly don't. I mean, you know, when the legislature creates a standard for one and not the other, and there's lots of times throughout Chapter 48 that it gives, you know, clear and convincing evidence standard, why we would write something into the statute that the legislature didn't. Legislature just said, you know, Your Honor, your job here is just to figure out what's best for the child, because we've already determined that the state has met its burden to show that this parent is on a question of what's best for the child.
I think the major distinction is that there's standards of proof and burdens of proof. And so the standard of proof at disposition is the child's best interest. But what are we proving that to? Is it kind of in the child's best interest? Is it mostly? Is it absolutely? These are different ways of saying burdens of proof. And I think at this point, there's a danger that it's being inconsistently applied across the state, because maybe one judge thinks it only needs to be mostly in the child's best interest, but another judge might think it needs to be absolutely in the child's best interest, and we have no guidance on what level we need to get to in an evidentiary sense.
What's your... tell us why this is a problem we need to resolve.
Your Honor, in this specific case, I think that determining the burden of proof is paramount to deciding if there's even an issue or an error under Bangert. If the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence, there's no error under AG's argument for the Bangert requirements, at least as to that burden of proof issue. But as to more globally, I go back to this idea, having clarity for parents, having consistency for parents and children, in being very clear on what that burden of proof is, I think is very important. And I think there's ambiguity there. The court saw that in this case, in AG, the Court of Appeals says, quote, there is no burden of proof at disposition. There's another case from District 1 right now, which is in abeyance in front of this court, State versus MB, where a different judge at the Court of Appeals in District 1 said, well, clearly, there must be a burden of proof at the petitioner, at the dispositional phase. Inherently, that is statutory ambiguity. We find that there's ambiguity in a statute relative to two different reasonable people understanding it differently. And we have two judges at District 1 who understand it differently. So the standard is best interests. I posit under State versus Ex Rel Kalal, that when we look at the full chapter, as you noted, in 4831, the legislature has indicated that it's clear and convincing evidence at jurisdiction or the grounds phase. Because TPR is a bifurcated but singular proceeding, I am arguing and asking that this court find that the legislature intended that it be clear and convincing evidence, and or that the statutory construction of Chapter 48 errs in favor that it is clear and convincing evidence at disposition.
So this wasn't briefed, though, right?
Your Honor, this was...
Well, you raised it, but this wasn't one of the issues that was before us when we took this case, correct?
Your Honor, the idea that there would be broader consequences from the Court of Appeals opinion was very clear at the petition for review. 12-14 of my petition for review, I look at the treatment of the colloquy and the analysis of the burden of proof issue from the Court of Appeals. By the time the first brief came around, the meat of that issue had become more clear as to how District 1 was splitting and how appeals were rolling in. Again, I don't concede that it is waived. I know AG believes that this is waived.
Well, more so than just whether it's waived or not, we like to give everyone a chance to be heard, especially if you're asking us to interpret something, and it really isn't the crux of the case here. Is this the forum to do it in, or maybe we do it in the case that we've held?
Your Honor, I think that this is the forum. I think that the burden of proof issue is inextricably intertwined with the accuracy of the Bangert issue, and it's...
Well, explain to me how you said if it's clear and convincing, they've met it. If it's anything lesser than that, they've met it. If there's no standard, they've met it, right? Aren't you going to argue no matter what it is, you prevail it to not letting him withdraw his plea? So is it really that connected with the outcome in this case?
I think it is still connected with the outcome. I do agree with your analysis that any burden of proof has been met on the specific facts of this case. However, I think that I go back to the need for clarity and consistency across the state and even within District 1 has become eminently clear by the differences in how District 1 is treating it and the deluge of appeals that have come in as a direct result of these cases. As to my second point, this case is a factual showcase in why Bangert's rigid application to TPR proceedings leads to absurd results. The Court of Appeals misconstrued Bangert, Finley, and Brown when it determined that particular evidence or procedure were necessary to prove voluntariness in this case, when it determined what evidence should be presented, and more specifically, when it determined what evidence was not allowed. The Court of Appeals rejected pre-plea evidence as too old, but it also rejected disposition evidence from 24 hours later as after the plea and thus not relevant to the case. Under Bangert, a circuit court was empowered to search the entire record, and it wasn't until later cases that that review was limited to an evidentiary hearing after a prima facie case. This may be appropriate in some criminal cases, but it is inappropriate in TPR where there is additional fact-finding that may definitively show understanding from a plea.
We have a litany of cases going back almost to 20 years regarding the termination of parental rights employing the Bangert procedure. Why should we overrule those?
I see that I'm out of time. May I briefly answer your question?
Briefly.
Your Honor, the cases that I think you reference that tend to change Bangert's original point all occur after this court decided that Bangert applies to TPR. This court decided that it applies to TPR in 2000 in Waukesha County versus Stephen H., and when applying it to TPR, did not consider Hampton, Brown, Howell, Finley, or any of the other progeny cases from Bangert. Does that answer your question?
Well, as to perhaps that 2000 case, but the other cases subsequent, but you've answered it in one sentence, and that's just fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead and have a seat.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Chris Sobick. I'm from the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent the father, AG, in this matter. During the grounds phase of a termination of parental rights case, the parent's rights are paramount. As such, a parent is entitled to several legal safeguards during the grounds phase of a TPR matter before a court can find that parent unfit. For example, in a case like this one where a parent enters an admission or a no contest plea to grounds, circuit courts are required to ensure that the parent's plea is entered knowingly. In essence, the court needs to make sure that the parent understands the stakes involved when they enter their admission or no contest. One of the things that a circuit court needs to do to make sure that a plea is entered knowingly is ensure that a parent understands the potential dispositions that the parent faces after they enter a plea to grounds. Here, in this case, the court did not review the potential dispositions with AG during the court's plea colloquy when AG changed his plea.
Which disposition did the court not review?
Sure. So at the plea hearing in this case, what the court said to AG is that During the disposition phase, the court decides, is it in the child's best interest to, in fact, terminate your parental rights? I don't believe that statement conveys the potential dispositions in a TPR case. That statement does not convey to the parent that the court has two options, and those options are basically all or nothing. Either the court terminates the parent's rights, or the court dismisses the petition. And the court did not specifically tell AG that those were the only two options that it had under the statute.
This feels like magic words to me.
Sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
It's okay. It just feels like you're I don't know. It feels like you're asking circuit court judges to say magic words, to thread a needle with a really small eye. I mean, saying that the court is going to decide whether parental rights will be terminated, whether implies that it could go one way or it could go another. And I know that in your briefing, you talk about, you cite a case, and I can't remember which case it was, where it talks about the word driving factor. And this is in relation to the best interest of the child in a disciplinary hearing. I just feel like your argument really has a lot of, like, if the court doesn't say these exact words, then there's no way a parent could understand what's happening, and we need to redo all these pleas.
I am not advocating for magic words. I think there are probably numerous ways that a court could convey to a parent that they only have these two options at disposition. What the court said here didn't do that. I mean, what the court said here left it somewhat ambiguous. I mean, a parent hearing what the court said here could think that potentially there's some middle ground disposition where the court hears all the testimony and evidence at disposition and the court makes a decision to just hold this open for a length of time to let the parent get their life back on track. Or
the statement was the court decides whether parental rights will be terminated. I don't know how anyone would infer any of what you're talking about from that statement.
I understand what you're asking. I guess
if I say to you, do you know whether it's going to rain today? I mean, the answer is, yeah, it's gonna, or no, it's not. It's not like, I don't know, it might be cloudy with partly cloudy and windy, right? It's like, do you know whether it's going to rain today? Yes, no. Whether the parental rights are going to be terminated? Yes or no?
I just don't believe the court saying, I'm going to decide, in fact, whether to terminate your parental rights conveys that those are the only options the court had. It's one of the options the court has is to terminate the parental rights, but it doesn't convey it's one of only two possible all or nothing options.
So what do you want us to do about it? In an opinion, what are you asking us to say? That courts must list out, I am going to decide, one, whether your rights will be terminated, or two, whether they will not be?
I believe there's cases interpreting the options that the court has, indicating that a court has to tell a parent that it has to make one of two decisions in the case, terminate or dismiss the petition. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's asking a lot of a circuit court to parse those out so that a parent understands that those are the only two things that is available to the court once they've pled to the grounds phase in a case.
Are we supposed to just ignore all the proceedings that occurred before the plea was taken? Because Judge Sanders was the one who did the initial appearance, and that was one of the most thorough explanations in as plain of English as you will find, I think, in TPR proceedings. So there, he did go through all of the alternatives and explained that if he were the one to preside over the disposition hearing, could be another judge, but that he could continue the continuing CHIPS disposition order, a guardianship could be put in place. He identified multiple outcomes. So are we to presume in these cases that the parents cannot remember or will not remember what was told to them at prior hearings?
First, I'll say Bangert certainly lets a court look at the hearings that happen prior to the plea, and in this case, an example of that would be the initial appearance that Judge Sanders did. What I think is important to consider, though, is that at a Bangert evidentiary hearing, the state does have the burden to show by clear and convincing evidence that a plea was knowingly entered. And I don't believe that a hearing from 10 months from the actual date of the plea shows that an individual understood what they needed to understand at the actual plea hearing. It's too remote in time. And in this case, it's the only time where the dispositions were discussed.
I find that difficult to accept as somebody who did preside over many termination of parental rights hearings when I was a circuit court judge, because it's not that the parents are only in court once or twice. Typically, if they're involved in their case, they're in court numerous times. They also have case managers and other people who are explaining to them what's at stake. I mean, they know from the beginning that they could lose their right to their children, right? You concede that. I mean, it's a termination of parental rights. So they understand that that's what's at stake as soon as the CHIPS petition is filed. And, I mean, when parents are involved in their children's cases, they are aware, at a practical level, setting aside what is said in court, about what the options are. I mean, every case is different, right? Not every case is going to potentially result in a guardianship. Not every case is potentially going to involve foster care. I mean, every case is different, but parents kind of know what's at stake, right? They know where their children are when they're involved in the case. They know who's taking care of them. They know what the possible outcomes are. Do you disagree?
I think that actually highlights why a transcript from 10 months before isn't good enough, because parents, you're right, there's a lot of hearings, there's a lot of conversations likely with their lawyer, with social workers, but we don't know what's taking place in those conversations. We don't know if they're getting information that's completely different than what Judge Sanders told the parent at the hearing 10 months prior. And so a lot can happen in 10 months, and so a parent's understanding is somewhat fluid, potentially.
But that's why the judge asks, you know, do you understand? Sometimes they ask, do you have any questions about that? I mean, in my experience, sometimes people just say, yes, I understand, yes, I understand. So a lot of times people ask questions. They don't understand, or they want to clarify. They want to make sure that they understand. So is there any obligation on the individual parent to express to the court, when the court is asking, do you understand, to say, no, I don't?
I believe the obligation by statute is on the court to make sure that the parent knows and understands these things at the plea hearing.
But when the litigant is saying, yes, I understand, Judge, you don't think the court can take that at face value during what I think in this case, as in most cases, is a pretty extensive colloquy with the parent?
But nowhere within the actual plea colloquy, so not the initial appearance, did the court review the dispositions specifically. And then, as we'll get into later, the statutory standard was given incorrectly to the parent as well. And so how would a parent know? I don't think they would know to tell the court they don't understand something that they don't know they should be understanding.
We don't understand what we don't understand. Is that?
But that's, again, assuming that all knowledge of what happened before the day of the plea hearing is erased from the brain of the parent.
I'm not saying it's erased. What I'm saying is it's not good enough to show by clear and convincing evidence that a plea was entered knowingly. Is it evidence? Absolutely. But I don't think it reaches the standard of clear and convincing evidence.
Counsel, let's look at this case and this record. As I understand it, The state, once faced with the reality that the father was not there, said, and could have done something else, you know, continuance or whatever, said, no, we're going to go forward. we'll go forward. We'll go forward based on transcripts. And so the transcript that the state relied on was a 10-month-old transcript. And so that's what we have before us. We don't have all sorts of other transcripts that the state relied on, but we have this one. I think it's in the June, 10 months earlier. So that's what we have in the record that the state relied on. And unlike my colleague, I share some concern that was expressed by the Court of Appeals regarding the temporal nature in this case. You were told 10 months ago, the question under the statute is, in my mind, is the plea that is being made today knowingly and voluntarily made? So I'm sympathetic to this 10-month argument because I think based on this record, it carries a fiction that it's necessarily demonstrative of the knowledge of today. But I'll tell you where I have concerns. And that touches upon a question asked earlier about magic words. Magic words are an anathema to this court. So my goodness, if we say something, are you asking for magic words? You got problems. So here, as I understand it, you know, we've got the statute. And the statute clearly says what the court must do. And the court must make sure under 48.4422 sub 7 that the court must address the parties and must make sure the court shall tell them with an understanding of the nature of the acts alleged in the petition and the potential dispositions. That's what we have in 7A. And your argument really is, as I understand it, the court didn't say the word dismiss. Push back if I'm misunderstanding your argument. But that's what I understand your argument to be. The trial court here said the second half of the case is where the court decides, is it in the child's best interest to, in fact, terminate your parental rights? Do you understand that distinction between the first and the second part? And yes, I understand that distinction. So what does the court do? What is the court obligated to do under the statute? Must inform of the potential dispositions, and what are those dispositions? 48.427 sub 2 says one of the dispositions is the court may dismiss the petition if it finds that the evidence does not warrant the termination of parental rights. That's number 2. The other disposition set forth in the statute is the court may enter an order terminating the parental rights of one or both. So as I look at the transcript on page 8, the court didn't say dismiss. The court said it has to decide in the second phase, is it in the child's best interest to in fact terminate your parental rights? And some would argue that this is, you know, the court has to decide it is or it isn't. It's an either or. But, of course, the court didn't say the word dismiss. Am I understanding your argument? And I think I am. And push back if I'm not. And tell me why that isn't good enough on page 8.
Sure.
Even though it doesn't have the word dismiss in it.
I agree that the court did not excuse me, use the word dismiss. But I think my bigger argument... I think my bigger argument is that the court didn't let AG know that it had to make an all-or-nothing decision. And the all-or-nothing decision involved one of the two options, either dismiss or terminate. The way that the court explained the potential dispositions or what it said to AG that you quoted, Justice Bradley, it doesn't convey that that's it. Those are the two options, and that there's no other potential options. And so it doesn't leave apparent understanding that, you know, at disposition, a court can't just send the child home, or, like I was trying to discuss earlier, can't just hold the case open to let them improve their circumstances in life. It doesn't let a parent know that once they enter that plea, it's going to be all or nothing. Their rights are either being terminated or that petition's being dismissed. And the court has to make that decision.
Mm-hmm. So what should the court have said differently?
Again, I don't think I can prescribe exactly what the court has to say. But a court needs to convey that those are the two options and that is it.
If the court said you have two dispositional options, dismiss the petition or terminate parental rights, is that sufficient in your mind?
Yes. The court then has given the parent the two potential dispositions.
And if the court says there are two potential dispositions, grant the petition to terminate your parental rights or not grant your petition to terminate the petition to terminate parental rights, that's not sufficient.
No, I think that seems sufficient because it's putting the case into the two options and making it clear that those are the only two options and there's no other options.
So you're not requiring the word dismiss to be used?
No.
Are you requiring the word to?
No.
How about or?
Okay.
But going back to the question that was raised earlier, the court did use the word whether, and Justice Kurofsky gave the example of, you know, whether it's going to rain today.
Sure.
So it seems like there's not much daylight, no pun intended, between whether it's going to rain today or whether it's going to rain today or not. That, you know, roughly conveys the same thing. I have two things maybe just to point out in like your response to them. It's interesting that 48.422 sub 7 sub A doesn't actually say exactly what you need to tell them. It actually just says you need to address the parties present and then determine that it's made voluntarily and that this person understands the nature of the acts alleged and the potential dispositions. So it's not quite so specific about what words need to be said. And so that's maybe one observation.
Justice Sagedorn, I made an error.
Yes, the word whether is not there.
So
that's a little judicial license.
Right. Yeah, I'm going rogue over here. Mostly because I'm sitting in Justice Dalit's seat.
Oh.
the statement is you have a whole bunch of rights, the right to force the state to prove the grounds by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence to a reasonable certainty, and then she talks about the second half of the case. This is the quote. Second half of the case is where the court decides, is it in the child's best interest to, in fact, terminate your parental rights? That's my bad.
Yeah, there were a couple of other similar statements, too, that come after that, too. But it strikes me that some of the argument here in our Fourth Amendment cases, sometimes we've spoken negatively about the divide and conquer approach. That is, you find something that looks like it's a somewhat irrelevant factor standing on its own, and then you sort of discard it from the analysis. Some of the Court of Appeals reasoning looks to me a little like that. 10 months is too early, so we're going to kind of cast that aside. Not sure how helpful stuff that comes in after, we're going to kind of cast that aside. But generally speaking, when you're looking at the totality, if it was communicated to someone, and it was here, these are the two potential dispositions, and then later there is the we're gonna decide whether there's legal grounds to terminate your rights. And then the next day, you actually have testimony that seems to reflect that understanding. Why isn't that, you know, pot of soup put together sufficient under the circumstances, even if you could, you know, legitimately agree that 10 months is pretty remote, you know, standing on its own, and stuff that comes later might be a little less reliable to standing on its own?
Because I think if you take that evidence into consideration, the transcript from 10 months prior, and even if you look at the disposition and what took place there, those things still don't add up to clear and convincing evidence that at the decision point, when the parent entered the plea, that they understood the information that was required to be conveyed to them. And so there needed to be, in a case like this, something beyond that evidence to show that understanding at the time of the plea. I wanted to transition to what I view as a second problem with the plea hearing in this case. And I believe here that the court, the circuit court, misadvised AG regarding the statutory standard it would rely on at disposition at the time of his plea hearing. The court told AG that the state would have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that termination was in the child's best interest in order for that to take place. That is not an accurate statement of disposition and the standard the court is supposed to consider. Disposition is a place where a court is tasked with exercising its discretion. The court has to exercise its discretion and decide whether termination is in the child's best interest or not. But there is not a burden of proof level, and there certainly isn't a clear and convincing evidence burden of proof level at that stage.
But here I think, if I read the transcript correctly, the trial court actually made the finding at the dispo stage, right, that it was by clear and convincing evidence, and then in the post-conviction decision said, look, your client got the benefit of the doubt here. It was a high standard. So how is your client prejudiced at all?
Well, I mean, for starters, the Bangert analysis doesn't ask the courts to look at harmlessness. What Bangert says is we look at the decision point when the parent enters the plea, and we determine whether that plea is knowing. And if a parent enters a plea that isn't knowing, then we can't let that plea stand. So then what the court does later on really is irrelevant to that question. The other problem with that, in looking at this through the harmlessness lens, is if AG had appealed what took place at the disposition, an appellate court wouldn't use clear and convincing as its sort of guide to decide whether or not the circuit court made the correct decision at disposition. It would review the disposition for an erroneous exercise of discretion. So he wouldn't get the benefit of the circuit court saying that it used a clear and convincing standard.
Well, don't we have case law in the criminal context that talks about, in the context of a plea, that if you were to misadvise a defendant about the penalty and you say it's more than possible, and then that's fine? I mean, this isn't out of the realm of possibility. It's not just applying this harmlessness standard. It's basically, what would have changed? It's how did that, I guess it is harmlessness, but how did it hurt you? But we do that in the Banger context in the criminal decisions.
I think there are a couple cases that talk about, I believe it's in substantial defects. And what those cases, at least my understanding is, say is that because the defect in the court's colloquy is so small that there's not actually a Bangert violation. They haven't done anything wrong based on what they're required to discuss at a colloquy. That's different here. I mean, the court is required to discuss the statutory standard with the parent, and in doing so here, went as far as to misadvise the parent. And I think that is important because based on the circuit court's explanation, AG or a different parent is led to believe that the state has to carry a pretty substantial burden in order for their rights to be terminated. When in reality, all it is an exercise of discretion by the court.
So in reality, if we were to answer this question that we're being asked on the other side to answer in terms of what the burden is, you would say it's discretionary decision. It's not a burden.
Correct.
At the dispositional stage.
Correct. It is an exercise of discretion. That's how disposition determinations are reviewed by appellate courts.
And so your argument, as I understand it, is because AG was told that there would be this high burden, perhaps AG thought that the state wouldn't be able to meet that burden, but the reality was there wasn't this high burden. It was discretionary, and therefore there was a defect because perhaps AG would not have pled or given up the rights in the grounds phase had AG known what would happen in disposition.
Correct.
Who has the burden of production, not the burden of proof? Who has the burden of production in the dispositional stage?
So, again, disposition, we look at the court exercises its discretion there. And in order to exercise that discretion, the court has to be given some evidence to exercise that discretion and make a determination in a TPR case considering some of the factors a court needs to consider. In deciding what disposition to go down. In a case like this one, and frankly in most cases, you know, the state filed this petition, they've made the decision that they want the parents' rights to be terminated, and so it likely falls on them to produce that evidence so that the court has enough to exercise its discretion in order termination in a case.
One would think so, yes, because these are factors that are set forth that the court has to consider, and someone has to have the burden of, as we say, going forward or burden of production. How does that inform, if at all, whether there is a burden of proof, and if so, who has it?
It doesn't at all, because there isn't a burden of proof. The court is just required to consider what is in the best interest of the child, and in doing so, there's certain factors the court has to consider, and then the court exercises its discretion in making its decision. But those factors or what is in the child's best interest doesn't have to be proven to any sort of required standard, like clear and convincing or reasonable certainty or whatever standard or a burden of proof you could fit in there. One of the other things that I did want to address, because it was talked about at length during the state and the GAL's arguments, is that I don't believe that there's any real reason to change Bangert as it applies to termination of parental rights cases. I do believe that it establishes a solid process for courts to determine whether a plea is knowingly, voluntarily, and entered in a case. TPR cases, just like criminal cases, can have information from all sorts of places in the record or from individuals from outside of the record that can speak to whether a plea was knowingly entered. And so I do believe that Bangert is appropriate and there's no need to change it. And I haven't heard a reason why it needs to be changed for TPR-type cases. I also would ask this court to determine that any request by the state or the GAO at this point to enter any sort of default judgment against AG for his non-appearance at the post-disposition hearing is forfeited. Certainly, the state and the GAO both had an opportunity at that hearing to ask for a default judgment or object to his non-appearance and made the determination not to do those things. I don't think they can now bring that issue up in this court for the very first time.
Can you give us your position on the request to add the clear and convincing evidence standard to the DISPO best interest of the child determination that the court has to make?
My opinion is, are you asking if that standard exists at the disposition phase, or I guess I don't quite understand the question.
I don't quite understand the question I asked either. Fair enough. We've been at this a little while. My understanding is from the arguments, especially from the other side of the table, is that they are asking us to decide that there is a standard at that phase and that that phase is by clear and convincing evidence. And I'm curious as to what your position is on that request.
That the court does not need to do that, nor should the court. The statute makes it clear that clear and convincing evidence applies to the grounds phase. And then the consideration that the court must make at the disposition phase is simply what's in the best interest of the child. And that is an exercise of discretion that the court has to make. And there's no burden for the state to prove that termination is appropriate.
What language do you rely on that the trial court said that shows that she instructed AG that she was in fact applying clear and convincing evidence to the disposition phase?
Sure.
Can't you read that both ways? Like, I don't know, it depends how you read it, right? So what's the language you're relying on?
I don't think you can read it both ways. I think it's pretty clear that the court was saying that that burden of proof applied at disposition. The court told AG that at the trial on grounds, he basically had a whole bunch of rights, and then immediately told him that the first of those rights was to force the state to prove grounds by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence by reasonable certainty. Then later on during the disposition, or excuse me, during the plea hearing, the court then told AG that he had all those same trial rights at disposition. But one of the trial rights the court had just given was proof by clear and convincing evidence. And so it seems to me there's the only way to take that is that that burden of proof also applies to disposition, which the court also described as an evidentiary hearing. Based on that, that unless the justices have any other questions for me, I don't have anything else to cover at this point.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Battle?
Can you address that last argument that Mr. Sobeck made? That it does appear that the court was instructing AG that AG had all those same trial rights at disposition, and that was described as being clear and convincing evidence.
I can address that, Your Honor, and I would disagree with AG's attorney's interpretation. What the court stated, and I quote, on page 8, that AG would have the right to force the state to prove the grounds by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence to a reasonable certainty. The trial court then went on to separately list a enumerated list of rights, such as right to call witnesses, right to cross-examine, and then does harken back and say that you have those same rights. There is a break, and the trial court also specifically equivocates that the clear and convincing standard applies to grounds in her statement. The state does not concede that there is a defect in the colloquy. However, at this procedural state, we're post-evidentiary hearing. And really what we have is a lot of dispute and concern regarding the trial court's statement that the second phase is for the court to determine whether it is, or where it is in fact to determine is it in the child's best interest. There is nothing factually incorrect about the information that the trial court gave to AG. AG alleged in his underlying pleadings that AG made inferences that led to incorrect information, that AG inferred that there may have been other potential dispositions, that AG inferred that the court meant that clear and convincing was the standard at disposition as well. Taking the trial court's words at their face, coupled with the information that was provided to AG at the initial appearance, coupled again with AG's own testimony at the disposition, the state would argue that it has met its burden. The significance of AG's non-appearance lies in these alleged inferences. AG has alleged these misunderstandings or these alleged connections that he drew and then failed to appear at the very court date that was set to tease this out. He asked the trial court for a post-disposition evidentiary hearing on the knowing, intelligence, and voluntariness of his plea after he made these alleged misunderstandings, and he failed to appear for that very hearing that he requested.
Yeah, but the state went forward. I mean, you didn't have to.
The state did choose to go forward in this case on the transcripts. Functioning under the Chapter 48 mentality of the best interest of the child, the state's concern was in the fact that this child that is subject to this litigation needs some permanency. And the concern was that AG did not appear. AG's trial appellate counsel conceded he was aware of the proceedings. No explanation was given for his absence. And there is no real protocol to force AG to participate in the hearing that he requested. It's not common for a subpoena to be issued. Even if a subpoena was issued, it doesn't mean that he would have appeared. AG's failure to appear should not lead to a situation where a parent can delay permanency for a child indefinitely by failing to participate in a proceeding that they requested.
Counsel, absent an order for appearance by the court issued for this proceeding, what authority do you point to that in this hearing it is required for the father to appear?
AG did have notice. AG was sent notice, and as I indicated, the trial court had previously ordered him to appear.
For this hearing?
The trial court did not distinguish what hearings that AG was ordered to appear or not appear for. The trial court had advised AG at the initial appearance that he was ordered to attend all hearings.
I just don't want the law to reflect in this kind of a case that if the father doesn't appear, absent an order for appearance rather, that he's required to appear. I don't think there's any law that says that.
Your Honor, I recognize that the red light has...
Answer briefly.
Thank you. Ultimately, this is a request by AG for relief.
Where's the law? Just show me the law.
I would rely on the court's order that he was required to appear.
And absent a court's order, is there any law that you can point to?
I would have to brief that, and I would be willing to do so if the court would require it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, first I want to highlight again, the trial court in this case never misadvised AG. The trial court indicated that he would have the same trial rights today for the second half after clarifying that AG understood the difference between the first and second half of the case. When she says that you have the right to force the state to prove the grounds by clear and convincing evidence, she later says that the second half is about where the court decides, is it in the child's best interests to in fact terminate your parental rights? The Court of Appeals ignores that she explicitly advised him on the standard of proof in this case as the child's best interests, and she never decisively told him that it was clear and convincing evidence. Now, of course, I'm also asking you to find that it's clear and convincing evidence. But insofar as the
found enough.
Insofar as the actual error in this case, she never told him that. Turning to a question from Your Honor as to the burden of production, AG concedes that the state has the burden of production. I think, as Your Honor may have been thinking, a burden of production necessarily implies a burden of proof. If there's a burden of...
I wasn't thinking that, no.
Okay. I would posit that a burden of production necessarily implies a burden of proof. If you have a burden to produce evidence, how much must you produce? And I go back to the idea that we do not terminate parental rights in this state lightly, or we shouldn't. A child should have a right to be parented by their biological parent, and it should be difficult for the state to terminate parental rights. A parent's constitutional right to their child essentially ends at ground with that unfitness finding, but where does a child's constitutional right to be parented by their parent end?
In some ways a lot like a criminal trial, right? So you have an initial verdict that adjudges someone guilty, and then you go to the sentencing phase. And in sentencing, you don't have a burden, you just have factors that need to be considered. And the statutory structure for this looks quite the same. There's an initial grounds phase with a burden and a standard, obviously lower than in a criminal case. And then the second phase, disposition, is just a standard, a North Star, the best interest, plus enumerated factors that need to be considered. And that's the structure that the legislature seems to set out. So I don't understand why a list of factors automatically assumes a burden. There are lots of places in the law where trial courts do make those judgment calls, as your opposing counsel, you know, points out.
Your Honor, I would argue that they are inherently different because of the same trial rights that were available to AG at that second phase. The right to cross-examine witnesses, the right to present evidence, the right to testify, all of these things under oath is an inherent difference to sentencing, where it's reports, it's the victim, there's no cross-examination allowed, there's not an inherently evidentiary hearing and court trial occurring at a sentencing phase in criminal cases, whereas we are explicitly going to a court trial in a TPR case to find new evidence as to the child's best interests.
If we were to determine that there was not a standard of clear and convincing evidence that applies to the second phase, is there a problem with the colloquy here, which seems to say that there is, and therefore maybe as defense for AG argued, a problem with AG being told that the state would have to rise to this higher level when the state doesn't have to rise to that level, and maybe AG would have considered not entering that plea to the grounds if that was the case?
Your Honor, I think that there's an inherent issue with two sets of inferences that this court is expected to believe that AG made. The first is that he heard same trial rights when the burden had been clarified as being only about grounds, and believed that to mean that the clear and convincing evidence is the standard of, or the burden of proof at disposition, and I'm hanging my hat on that. I see I'm out of time. Could I briefly
finish the sentence?
Thank you. The other inference is that AG cannot figure out the either or of to in fact terminate or to not in fact terminate. The court did not explicitly tell him that there was a burden of proof at disposition, and we are expected to believe he made an inference that seems unlikely. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you for interesting arguments. We've concluded the third case of the day. We will meet in closed conference at about 10 after 3.